can have a planet orbiting the sun in three dimensions, but remember, one of Newton's insights was the other planets gently perturb you out of your orbit, right? It's not just you and the sun moving around in the solar system. We also have Jupiter and Mars and Venus and all those other things. So it is only in three-dimensional space that planetary orbits are stable. So what about dimensions greater than three? These orbits would be unstable. What does that mean? It means that, you have some position, you have some velocity or some momentum, okay. What if you just, you're going around in some orbit, what if you just tweak it a little bit? What if you have some force, like another planet, that moves you away from your orbit? What would happen in dimensions larger than three is that rather than just being in a slightly different orbit, you would either spiral into the center or escape to infinity. Those are the generic things that could happen. That's what it means for the orbits to be unstable. You could move in a perfect circle, but if your circle is not perfect in four or five or six dimensions of space, then you could not orbit forever and ever and ever. So maybe we think that for intelligent life to arise, you need something like planets moving around stars in long-lived orbits. Again, I don't know that you really need that. I'm pretty much wholly unconvinced by this. The two-dimensional space, okay, I get it. It's hard for us to be quite this simple. But the four- or five-dimensional space seems like the complexity still has plenty of room to exist, even if the way that complex structures would arise would be very, very different in this kind of world than in ours. So I'm not sure that we have any reason yet to disbelieve on anthropic grounds that we could have lived in dimensions greater than three. Another way of saying this whole argument is the tying your shoelaces argument. Exactly because we said three dimensions are the number of dimensions in which strings can hit each other, generically, if you try to make a knot, if you try to literally tie a knot with a one-dimensional string in four dimensions of space, there are no knots that cannot instantly be undone, okay? So if you're in two dimensions, you can't tie a knot because the strings can't cross each other in the first place. If you're in four dimensions, they can always just pass right through and they can undo the knot. I have no intuition that tying your shoelaces is really, really important, but maybe that's the reason why we live in three-dimensional space. Okay. So again, I'm not here in this particular discussion to give you the final answer. I'm here to say these are potentially answerable questions and we should be thinking about them. Now, let's shift gears. Let's shift gears rather dramatically here. What I was just trying to do was explain how we can think about why space has three dimensions. Now I want to think about why is there space at all? Why is space a thing? And there's different angles you can take on this question, of course. Why is there the universe? Why does anything exist rather than nothing? That's a different set of questions. What I really mean by this is, why does the stuff of physics take the form of stuff living in space? Why can we organize the world into objects with locations, okay? That might seem like so big a question that we don't even know how to make the first little progress in answering it, but we actually do. There's a context in which we can address this question quite directly. And what that context is yet another reformulation of classical mechanics. Remember, we said that there was Newtonian mechanics, and this was the F equals ma way of doing things. So you have some particle or some object with a position and a momentum, and then you chug forward in time and ask what it does. Then we said that there is the least action way, which was you take an initial position and you take a final position, both with some fixed times, and you find the path in between them that minimizes a certain thing called the action. So it's a more global versus local point of view. You might think that those two options are all you get, but there is another way called the Hamiltonian point of view. So this is a way of formulating classical mechanics. It's not a different theory. It's yet another reformulation of exactly the same theory. It seems at first glance like a needless bit of formalism. okay? Like, you're taking something you understand perfectly well. The Hamiltonian point of view is very close to the Newtonian point of view. It's not really like the least action point of view, although there's a relationship there also. It's still, you start with initial conditions and you chug them forward in time, but how you phrase what the initial conditions are is a little bit different, and how you get the equations of motion is a little bit different. It's not just F equals ma. So it can, at first glance, seem just like a needlessly abstract mathematical reformulation, but once you get to higher level physics concepts, the Hamiltonian perspective is the way to go. For instance, in quantum mechanics, the Schrödinger equation relies completely on the idea that you have a Hamiltonian, and that's how you formulate physics. So what is going on here? Remember that phase space, which was the space of initial conditions, or conditions at any one time, was the space of positions, x, and momenta, p, okay? And we said that you could chunk forward in time by saying that the velocity is, let me say it this way, that the rate of change of position is given by the velocity, which is given by momentum over the mass, and the rate of change of the velocity over time is the acceleration, which is given by the force over the mass. This was the Newtonian way of thinking about it. So really, in the Newtonian way of thinking about it, the thing that exists, if you have space here, x, y, and this is time, okay, then you have a trajectory, x of t, and that's what matters. X as a function of time is what matters. The velocity is derived from the motion of x, okay? The Hamiltonian way is different. The Hamiltonian way says, look at this structure that we have of phase space here, okay, x and p. Put x and p on more of an equal footing. So rather than thinking of the momentum as something that is derived from position by taking the velocity then multiplying by the mass, p equals mv, this is the usual way of thinking about it, rather than doing that, say that the position and the velocity are two truly independent things, okay? And construct from these independent things a function of them, a function of phase space called the Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian, you know, it's basically the energy. That's what it is, right? So it's basically the energy. But it's the energy, what I'm saying basically is because it's the energy as a function of position and velocity. Position and momentum. That's the whole point, is that it's not a function of position and velocity, it's a function of position and momentum. So, you know, we said that the energy equals, sorry for the math here, but I think the concepts are easy enough to follow. Energy is kinetic plus potential. And we had little formulas. Kinetic energy is 1/2 mass times velocity squared. Potential energy is just some function v of x. It only depends on x, not on the velocity or the momentum. So if velocity is momentum divided by mass, then this equals 1/2 p squared divided by m. Right? If you plug in v equals p over v. And the potential is still just v of x. So in other words, this energy, this is now the Hamiltonian. It is a function of x and p. It equals 1/2 p squared over m plus v of x. See, there's no velocities that appear in there anymore, just momentum p and position x. Okay. Again, it seems like a kind of abstract, nonsensical way of rewriting things we already knew, but here's the point. There's a conceptual issue that comes along when people are first introduced to this, because if we go back to our picture of space, here's x, y, and time. I want to make that look like y. Time is up here, and we have this trajectory going here. You know, we say, look, if you have a point on the trajectory where the particle is moving with some velocity, okay, then how in the world can the velocity be independent of the position, right? It can't be. The velocity is derived from the position. That's all true. In this picture, that is true. But what I want you to try to imagine is that we, forgetting about the velocity, okay, we're imagining there's something called the momentum, And at every moment of time, let me just undo this, undo the complications of my picture. At every moment of time, we have two things. Let's even get rid of the trajectory, okay? We have the position x, and we have the momentum p. So the momentum is still a momentum, but these are two pieces of data that we're giving you, the location and the momentum. And then rather than saying the position is the momentum is defined to be the mass times the velocity, we say there are now two equations of motion. There's one equation that replaces F equals ma, forces mass times acceleration, which says that the velocity, the rate of change of the momentum, if you think about that, momentum was mass times velocity, so rate of change of velocity acceleration, this is just ma, which is just the force. That's an equation of motion. dp dt, I'm going to erase the part in between, equals F. That's the replacement for F equals ma. And there's another equation of motion that says that the derivative of position with respect to time, which is supposed to be velocity, velocity was p over m. So that's what it still is, p over m. So you see these two equations, change of position with time is force, change of momentum with time is force, change of position with time is momentum over mass. There's no mention of velocity here. These two equations are on an equal footing. And in fact, you can derive these two equations from this Hamiltonian function. I'm not going to try to tell you how to do it, but that's the point. So what you imagine is, just to start from scratch, imagine that instead of drawing space here, let me draw phase space. So this is x, and this is p, and there's some function on here, okay, called the Hamiltonian, which is a function of x and p. And by taking the slope of the Hamiltonian in different directions, I can derive these two equations of motion, the equation for p and the equation for x. So in other words, yet other words, when I am drawing this picture of a trajectory through time, and I say, look, here's the trajectory through time, here's the velocity v, how in the world could the momentum possibly be not in the same direction? How in the world could the momentum be a separate thing? The answer is the momentum is defined to be a separate thing, but on the actual trajectory, there will be a relationship p equals mv. Just like in ordinary mechanics, I have F equals ma, I can solve for the actual trajectory that the particle takes, but I can imagine other trajectories. I can imagine the particle doing whatever it wants, violating the laws of physics, right? The point is, P equals mv is not a definition, it's a new law of physics that you could imagine violating. You can imagine the momentum and the velocity pointing in separate directions, but they don't in the real world. That's the Hamiltonian point of view, okay? So the Hamiltonian point of view is you start with this function of phase space, x and p. You can derive these equations, and they are exactly the same as the equations of Newtonian mechanics. So why am I telling you this, right? That question will appear many, many times in these videos. Why am I telling you this? Why are we bothering with all this formalism? Well, the answer is because these equations and this picture really do put p and x on kind of an equal footing. Right? They treat them almost symmetrically. There's little details here, but basically, rather than p being derived from the velocity and therefore from the position, it has a life of its own. It's a quantity all by itself. There's the location, there's the momentum. These two quantities go into defining the Hamiltonian, and from them we get the laws of physics. So from that perspective, we've undone the idea that position is somehow prior to momentum. In Newton's way of thinking about it, were he to have defined momentum, he would just say, well, yeah, position over time is what matters. Momentum comes from that. Here we're saying that momentum matters all by itself, just as much as position does. So now we can ask, well, if that's true, why do we live in space? Why not living in momentum space? Momentum space exists. Again, it's not, that's the mathematician's use of the word space. It is a space of possible things. Phase space, which equals the set of all positions and momenta, is six-dimensional. But space is only three-dimensional. Why do we take this three-dimensional part of phase space that we call space and make it primary? Why do we make it central? Why do we make it the important thing? It's not even a question you would ask in good old Newtonian way of thinking about things. It was the important thing. We put that in. William Rowan Hamilton comes along. He invents the Hamiltonian way of looking at things. There's various senses, which we're not going to go into, in which the Hamiltonian way of looking at things is more fundamental, more powerful. And from that perspective, there's a new question you would never have thought to ask. Why don't we live in momentum space? So we don't fully know the answer to this, but we kind of know. This is a situation where we know the basic reason why things are the certain way they are. We just have yet to work out all of the details. And here is the basic reason why. Imagine that you have two billiard balls moving toward each other in good old Newtonian mechanics. Okay, so they have a position, x1, x2, and they have a momentum, p1, p2. And if they're billiard balls, so they don't have, you know, forget about the gravitational force of them or anything like that, neither of these billiard balls will know about the existence of the other one or be affected by it until they hit each other, right? Until they smack into each other in the middle. In other words, they do not interact until they are at the same point in space. There is no analogous question, no analogous statement about momentum. So if the two billiard balls had the same momentum or the opposite momentum, but were pointed in different directions, so they would never hit each other, they don't interact with each other. There's no sense in which having the same momentum or equal but opposite momenta has anything to do with whether you are interacting with each other. So the motto here is interactions. This is a simple example, but we can extend it and generalize it, are local in space, real space, the space of all possible positions. It's when you're at the same position that you interact with something, not when you're at the same momentum. And even if you do include gravity and things like that, we'll talk about this, but it's still true that you only interact when you're at the same position in space. So what this suggests, everyone knows this. This is not everyone knows this, but this is a well-known fact. Interactions are local in space, locality, okay, in physics. But to answer our question, why do we live in space? Why not momentum space? This fact that interactions are local in space suggests an answer. Space, as opposed to momentum space or phase space or anything like that, the space of all locations is the thing in which interactions are local. So in other words, if someone handed you a Hamiltonian as a function of position momentum, but they didn't tell you which was position and which was momentum, okay, you could figure it out. If this Hamiltonian was supposed to be, you know, the game that you play in physics, when I say there's a Hamiltonian function, what I mean is you tell me the physical system. It's some billiard balls, or it's some planets with gravitational fields, or it's a spring or a pendulum or whatever it is. And then you can figure out what the Hamiltonian of that system is. You know, we wrote down this simple thing, kinetic energy plus potential energy, but you can generalize that. Electromagnetism, standard model of particle physics, whatever it is. All of these different systems have their own Hamiltonian. In fact, they are defined by their Hamiltonian. Once you tell me what the objects are and what their Hamiltonian is, that defines the theory. So what I'm suggesting here is if someone gave you a Hamiltonian but disguised which parts of the phase space were positions and which were momenta, you could figure it out because you could look at that Hamiltonian and say, okay, what are the variables with respect to which different parts of the system are interacting locally when the variables take on the same values? And you would call that space. Okay, so there seems to be some sense in which you can understand why we live in space, why not momentum space. There's still a question, why are there any dimensions with respect to which interactions are local? Why is locality a thing? That I don't know. You know, that I have no clues right now. Why is there a locality? It's not because it necessarily needed to be that way. If you imagine the space of all Hamiltonians, the space of all theories of physics, most of them would not have any notion of locality whatsoever. It does not seem to be generic. There's something special about the real laws of physics that we have in our world that has this feature of locality, and as far as I know, no one's really sure why. But you should be inspired by the fact earlier in the video where we talked about even such a basic question as why are there three dimensions of space might be answerable in the right context. Maybe questions like this are answerable too, even though right now we don't have an answer. Maybe some of you have answers. I don't know. Let me wrap this up a little bit by saying, you know, by going back to the billiard balls and saying, okay, I said we ignore the gravitational force, right, between these two things, because if I have two objects, you know, let's ask about gravity. If I have two objects that are far away from each other, object one, object two, some distance r between them, the force between them, if this is capital M and this is little m, they both exert the same force on each other. That's an r there, just to be clear, which is Newton's constant times mass 1 times mass 2 over r squared. So big M pulls on little m pulls on big M. They're not at the same point in space. Did I lie to you? So Newton worried about this, right? This is action at a distance. He had this intuition that it makes sense for billiard balls to bump into each other when they're located at the same point in space, and yet his law of universal gravity seemed to say that even when things were not at the same point in space, they were still interacting with each other. And he worried about this. He wrote in the Principia Mathematica, this is an issue that he basically leaves for future generations to solve. He knew it was probably possible to do better. Very often when physicists talk about this, they give credit for answering this to Einstein. Einstein came up with general relativity, as we said, in 1915, and there is a gravitational field that is defined by the curvature of space-time, and there things are perfectly local. But in fact, the answer is already implicit in that sentence, but it way predates Einstein. The answer is there's a gravitational field. We use that language all the time. You probably use that language yourself. The gravitational field of the sun pulls on the Earth, okay? So, but there's a subtle but crucially important thing going on here. Newton's way of formulating it was, there just is a force acting on the Earth just because there exists the sun 93 million miles away, okay? There's nothing in between the Earth and the sun. It was our old friend, Laplace, Pierre-Simon Laplace. As far as I know, again, the history is not my thing, but this is what I think it was, who said you could rewrite Newton's law of gravity in terms of a gravitational potential phi as a function of x. Don't ask me why they call it phi, but that's what they often do. And so what Laplace said is if we plot phi, it's usually a negative number. So there you go. Here is the distance between, let's say, here's the sun, here's the Earth, and phi, it's on the vertical axis here, it looks like this. And he invented two equations. One equation was, what does phi do? And the answer is, when you have a big, massive object, phi pushes it down. Okay, that's why the sun is pushing down phi down here at r equals zero. The other equation says, if you're a little object, even if you're a big object, if you're an object that is in the midst of some phi, if you're feeling the influence of some phi, there is a force on you that is just like the force we talked about for potential energy before. That's why it's called the gravitational potential field. The force is minus the slope of the potential. So Laplace invents a set of equations which says there is something in between the sun and the earth, and that something is the gravitational field, the gravitational potential field, and I can write down equations for it where there's no action at a distance at all, right? Where the force, the influence of the sun on the field only happens where the sun is located, and then the field obeys its equation, which tells what is the field right there? It depends on what is the field right next to it on one side and what right next to it on the other side. And guess what? You use calculus to relate what the field is doing at one point to neighboring points. But that's all that affects it. All that the field at one point cares about is what the field is at immediately neighboring points. There's no influence very, very far away. So the action at a distance has gone away. It's field theory. This is the answer. Why is there no action at a distance? The answer is the world is made of fields. Or at least at this point of the analysis, forces come from fields. But we'll eventually get to the point where we just say the whole world is made of fields. That is the ultimate manifestation, the ultimate impact of locality. There is no action at a distance. Now, I should say this became more complicated, as many things did when quantum mechanics came along. We'll get to that at some later point. But if you've heard the phrase action at a distance, you may have heard it in the context of spooky action at a distance. And that appears in quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, the following thing can happen. I can have two particles that are spinning. So we will, draw this as one particle spinning that way, another particle spinning in the opposite direction. Okay, so we might call this spin up, spin down, and we might draw that in quantum mechanics as just an up arrow and a down arrow. Two particles can be spinning in opposite directions, okay? What can happen quantum mechanically, as you probably know, is that these individual particles with their individual spins might not be simply spinning up or down, but in some superposition, in some combination of spinning up or spinning down, until we measure them. And once we measure them, you will only ever get spin up or spin down, not some combination. So these two particles in quantum mechanics can be entangled with each other. The two-particle state can be a combination of both particles are spin up and both particles are spin down. In other words, you don't know the spin of either one particle if you observe it, but when you observe it, you instantly know the spin of the other particle. And furthermore, there's no reason at all for these two particles to be near each other. So you can have one particle over here and another particle over here. Let me draw this particle better, okay? So we don't know the spin of either one of these. This is usually in the trade Alice's particle and Bob's particle. So we know that both of these particles are spinning in the same way. In fact, even if you orient their spins to try to measure them in some other axis other than vertically, if you measure them horizontally or whatever, you always know they're spinning the same way. And what we don't know is what way that is. So when Alice measures her particle and she says, it's spinning up, then Alice instantly knows that Bob's particle is also spinning up. And if you believe that the quantum state is real, if it describes the real world, then it seems that Bob's quantum state changed instantly, even though Alice is very, very far away. So it seems like even though Newton and Laplace and Einstein had vanquished the idea of action at a distance in favor of locality and the importance of space and spatial location, quantum mechanics seems to be bringing back the idea of action at a distance, and Einstein did not like that. Happily, you cannot use this kind of entanglement in quantum mechanics to send signals, because even though Alice now knows what Bob's spin is, Bob still doesn't know. Bob has learned nothing from this, okay? Unless Alice tells Bob by some good old classical slower-than-light communication device, Bob is not able to do anything with the fact that Alice measured her spin. So it seems like a weird little loophole that the way that we talk about what's happening involves action at a distance, but no observational outcome is actually influenced by it. No information is transmitted. What are we going to do about that? We'll have to wait till future lectures to do something about that. For this one, I just want to emphasize that space has a meaning, but we're able, we're allowed, we're encouraged to interrogate what that meaning is and where it came from. Why is space three-dimensional? Why is there space at all? Might space be just emergent from some deeper quantum description or something like that? We can talk about that more. We're allowed to talk about that. That's the good news. The other thing, let me mention, for those of you who don't know, we do have a Q&A. If you have questions, leave them in the YouTube or in the blog post. I will try to answer some of them. Clearly, if we want to go further in this direction, we need to talk about time. So usually I'm going to try to keep the next big idea that we talk about secret, but given that we just talked about space, next time we'll talk about time.